It's Wisconsin Weekend. I'm Kate Archer-Kent.
And I'm Rob Ferret.
The plans for a home designed by Wisconsin's own Frank Lloyd Wright were on his drawing board when he died in 1959. And over six decades, the design remained unbuilt.
Now, a mother and daughter duo based in Ohio are taking on the project to finish this home, committing to keeping the architecture as authentic as possible.
And the Magnolia Network wanted to follow along. The show is called The Last Wright, Building the Final Home Design of America's Greatest Architect. It premiered this month with streaming available on HBO Max.
Sarah and Debbie Dykstra join us now to talk about their efforts to bring Frank Lloyd Wright's River Rock House to life. Debbie, thanks for joining us.
You're welcome.
And Sarah, thanks for being with us.
Of course. Thank you.
Well, Sarah, can you start us off with the story of the house and the plot of land it's on and the design plans? It's quite a story.
It is quite a story. It was the second house that Lewis Penfield had designed by Frank Lloyd Wright. And the reason he had it designed was halfway through the build of his first house, they announced the construction of Interstate 90. And it was going to go through or too close to his original house. And so he went back to Frank Lloyd Wright and said, you know, I need a new set of plans for a little bit further south on the property. And they kind of went back and forth and eventually made an agreement, signed some contracts, sent a check off, and waited. And then they waited a little longer and Mr. Wright passed away. So the Penfields at that point, the highway had been moved more north. So the first house was not going to get destroyed in the process. So they thought that the second set of plans died along with Frank until about a week after his funeral when they arrived. And they were designated in the archives as the last residential plans that he ever did.
And Debbie, talk us through what led from, hey, we've got this land with an already existing Frank Lloyd Wright house on it, and we've got this document that's designed for a house, to the decision to actually say, we're going to build this house.
Well, when we were in the process of purchasing, Sarah had written a letter to the son of Lewis, Paul Penfield, and promised that we would build this house. We were trying to sway him so he would sell it to us. And it, even though it was for sale, he had other developers and whatnot going to buy it or were considering it. So because we were a family and we were all going to plan on living here and we promised to build this house, I think what sold him into selling it to us.
Sarah, can you paint a picture of this house? Now, we're in Wisconsin. We've got houses with, I think, similar Frank Lloyd Wright designs. I stayed in a vacation rental designed by one of his students or mentees. Paint us a picture of this house that you set out to build here.
Sure. Well, we're on 30 acres along the Chagrin River Road in Willoughby Hills, Ohio. And it's just very picturesque, you know, the streams, the eagles, the deer, and both homes sit up on a ridge, both the Lewis Penfield house and River Rock. But River Rock is kind of built into the ground and overlooking the ledge. So it looks a lot different than Penfield House. It's all rock. It has a massive point and cantilever that overlooks the land and down into the river. You can't see all of the river from up here, but it's just right there, and it kind of pulls you to go towards that river.
Debbie, as I understand Frank Lloyd Wright, you couldn't take this plan from River Rock and build it somewhere else, right? This was a building that was designed to be on this exact spot. Tell us a little bit about how it fits in on the landscape.
Well, it was designed to go 60-some degrees off of a particular poplar tree that is on this property, and there's actually two. 70 years ago, it would have been fine, but because we were doing it now, created a problem with the roots. We were afraid we were going to lose it, but this house sits right on this particular piece because of that poplar tree, and we decided to make it as authentic as possible. We had to stick to that particular spot, try to save that poplar tree, and so far so good, and it just juts right out over the edge, just like Sarah said. And in the winter, you can see the river. In the spring and summer, it's kind of difficult because of all the trees, but It just sits right here where it's supposed to.
Now, Sarah, you describe yourself on the show as a retired lady and a never-built-a-house lady. Okay, so you're taking this plot of land, you're building it here. What? How daunting a task was this for the two of you?
Well, the mother's the retired lady, but she had had some experience building in the past. And we come from a family of builders over 110 years here in Lake County, Ohio. And so it was daunting. It was definitely nerve-wracking, all of those things that you can imagine. The pressure of doing it exactly right for Mr. Wright and for the Penfields. But being an IT person, I have that like timeline sense of projects that once we started going, it really, you know, and I learned a lot. I had to learn a ton. I just had to stay a little bit ahead of everybody. Not my mom and not my uncle who helped a lot in the build, but you know, whoever was coming next to perform some work on the house. All those scary anxiety words were there at the beginning and throughout the project, but I just come from a family where you just keep going. You know, you can't weigh in on all of that anxiety. You have to keep pushing forward and get to the next step.
Debbie, this design was from 1960. There are some changes that had to be made. I saw a bit where you were looking at the materials involved, and there was sheets of asbestos. Can't do that anymore. What kind of compromises did you have to make with modern housing codes and product availability?
And not too many in the code side of things, but we had to put in extra steel in the roof system. We also had to change the wood because you couldn't get the Philippine mahogany, but we had to have something just as strong because we changed the glass in the windows. It was a quarter inch glass and now it's a half an inch. All those things help keep that cantilevered roof line in the great room overlooking the edge up and strong. It would have sagged with anything else. So we went with the Sapelli mahogany, which was almost as strong as I don't know what kind of scale they measure the strength, but it was almost as strong as the Philippine mahogany, but you can't get that anymore. So we had to go differently.
And Sarah, the budget 1960 money was $25,000. I'm guessing in 2020's money, that wouldn't have gotten you very far.
No.
Maybe the doors.
I'm trying to think of what would have cost that much. Yeah.
The blueprint, probably.
Right. Yeah, it was definitely a different scale of money in 2025. But it was, I think I say at one point, I told somebody it was less than our first bid, but a lot more than 1959, 1960.
We're talking to Sarah and Debbie Dykstra. They're a mother-daughter duo living in Ohio. Magnolia Network is following their journey to build a home designed by Wisconsin's own Frank Lloyd Wright. The show is called The Last Wright. Now, what is it about Frank Lloyd Wright that the two of you love? Let's throw this one to Debbie first this time. What is it that grabs you about Frank Lloyd Wright's architecture?
Well, that's a really difficult question. Well, for one thing, I've always been a learner, so I love to learn about new things. So diving into Frank Lloyd Wright architecture for me was a learning experience, just like with my daughter, only on a different level. And if you look at the way he built things versus the way things are built today, it's completely different. So it was a big learning experience. And there's no other architect like him around ever, as far as I know. And I know pretty much about, you know, architecture, and I've traveled quite a bit. But his thought process as far as the inside outside, people have taken that, but he did it first. And I have always loved being outside, and I love feeling like even when I'm sitting in the house, this house, it's got 18-foot windows. I mean, you feel like you're sitting outside, only you don't feel the weather change. And to me, that was really important. He also started the great room concept, of which, many, many, many houses built since then have gone that route. So there's just concepts and things that he did that, you know, weren't being done. He was far ahead of his time, in not just with Usonian builds, but with every kind of building he did.
Sarah, did you catch the Frank Lloyd Wright bug from her?
I think I had it first, because I like the, she likes the cozy, warm, snuggly houses, and I like all the straight lines. So I picked up on those things from Mr. Wright a long while back. And that's what really caught my eye, even when we looked at the listing to buy this property. The first picture was the floating staircase that you see at the Penfield House. And I immediately was like, what is this mid-century looking thing? Because we didn't know that there was even a Frank Lloyd Wright house here in Willoughby when we grew up. We had all moved away. We'd moved down to Florida. And by the time we had left, the Penfields weren't renting it. They were using it as a personal home when we were growing up. So we didn't even know it was here. So all of those things, those straight lines, the glass, the rock, all of that kind of stuff has always drawn me into Frank Lloyd Wright's designs. But learning about his philosophies and the compression and release and the passive solar energy systems that he built into the houses is just, some of those things you're just like, holy cow, how on earth in 1950 did he think of some of these things?
Or before,
yeah.
I got to ask, Debbie, the two of you are not only going through this difficult process of, you know, making this house as true as you can to Frank Lloyd Wright's original vision. You're also doing it with camera crews looking over your shoulder for the last right. What was it like to be going through this process and be, you know you were being captured for TV?
Well, I'm 74, and this definitely was the strangest part of my entire life. And my daughter will say the same thing. In fact, she probably coined that phrase first, but it truly was. I mean, you know, there are times you have to be quiet. Well, I just, you know, don't live those lines. I mean, it was a great experience. We learned a lot of, as far as that goes. They learned from us because my specific thing initially was we only do three takes. We're not going to make this like a regular movie where we have lines. I'm not going to remember what you told me 10 minutes ago, so get it in the first three takes. So it was a strange situation, but our whole family was involved at some point or another, and that was very exciting to have them, you know, forever be remembered also, or for their children or grandchildren.
Now, the show just started airing, so I know you probably don't want to do a lot of spoilers, but Debbie, what is your vision for the final product? What is it going to be used for? Somebody living in it, renting it? What will River Rock be doing?
Well, my daughter wanted to live in it, and I said, absolutely not, because this house is really meant to be seen by other people. So we will use it as an Airbnb-type situation, where people can come and stay two nights and they can go all over the property. We have trails everywhere. And I hope they do come, because staying in this house and just being in it for several hours is just amazing. It's a different feeling than any other house I've ever been in. And they're both available to do that. So that's my hope. People will come, they'll open up the cabinets, they'll read everything. We have the set of plans here. We have pictures, we have books, and my thing throughout my entire life is that you should try to learn something new every day, and if you come here, I guarantee you, you won't leave here with an empty brain if you don't want to, because it's just a learning experience as well as an emotional experience.
Now, we're in Wisconsin here, so I got to ask, Sarah, we've got Taliesin here, right? Frank Lloyd Wright's HQ for a long time. You can do whole tours of buildings he designed or his protégés designed around Wisconsin. Did you, Sarah, and your mom make the pilgrimage out here, or do you plan to?
We definitely plan to. We did not get out there yet. We did the we went out to New York and met with Roland Reisley, who's the oldest original only owner of a Frank Lloyd Wright house. We went to Falling Water because we did do some field trips with the production crew. So they set those up. But our next journey is going to be to come out to Wisconsin. I know that we have what they call a Juliet balcony off of our primary bedroom in River Rock. And I think that the only other house that has that is the Johnson House. So I'm dying to see how that looks from, you know, comparing the two. So we are definitely going to make it out there very soon.
Congratulations on the show, and I look forward to having you here in Wisconsin. Thanks for joining us.
Thank you. Thank you very much.
Thank you.
Debbie and Sarah Dykstra are a mother-daughter duo in Ohio. They set out to build a home based on the last known design of Wisconsin's own Frank Lloyd Wright. They share that experience on the Magnolia Network show, The Last Wright, Building the Final Home Design of America's Greatest Architect. So ahead, a Milwaukee poet searches for meaning in fear and grief with a new collection of poems that reflect on the COVID-19 pandemic.
These poems have helped me to recognize that I do have emotions. I may not communicate them very well with people, but I've discovered them in me.
The book is called When and If. That's next on WPR News. It's Wisconsin Weekend. I'm Rob Ferret.
And I'm Kate Archer-Kent.
It's been almost 6 years since the COVID-19 pandemic devastated the world, and for one Wisconsin poet, the millions of people who died from COVID still weigh heavily on his mind.
DeWitt Clinton is a UW-Whitewater Professor Emeritus of English. His new poetry collection is called When and If.
It reflects his feelings during and since the pandemic, reminding us that we all experienced the worldwide health crisis together and are still recovering in our own ways.
Here's an excerpt of his poem titled Not Exactly, with reflections on contact tracing.
Heck, it's hard to remember anything yesterday, let alone all the times we've been in contact with someone else out there. So just don't try to make a big deal out of it and enjoy what you have right now, because believe me, and I'm not the only one who knows this, it's more than likely not going to turn out like you hoped it would.
DeWitt Clinton joins us now to talk more about poetry. DeWitt, thanks for being here.
I'm glad to be here with you and all of your staff.
Well, we're going to explore this new collection, but first I'm drawn to what looks like an oil painting on the cover. Can you explain its significance?
Yes, this is a painting. It's from Jeannie Tomusko, who is living near somewhere in one of the suburbs of Madison. It was a delight to find her work.
What does the painting mean to you?
Well, it's abstract and somewhat pastoral and somewhat calming. And those were themes that I thought might be helpful to perhaps get readers to open the book.
You know, When and If is a departure from your other works, and it explores these very personal feelings, complex feelings, especially around the COVID pandemic, which is in our collective memory. I'm wondering what caused you to pursue writing about the pandemic?
Because I was terribly afraid. That's it. Every day we received, pardon me for choking up, every day we would receive news notices on how devastating it was in so many places of the world, and how hospitals were using parking lots for refrigerated trucks for corpses. It was just scary. Still is. I just got another COVID vaccination shot a few days ago, and I was thinking, I thought this was over. No, I think we'll have this one, and I'm sure people are being infected by COVID as we speak. The book is essentially a Kaddish, or a memorial to all those who did die in the pandemic, as well as someone in my home who didn't die of pandemic, but from other illnesses.
Can you talk about Jacqueline and the grief you had over your wife's death and how this poetry is informed by that?
Well, one thing to add is that while my wife was fading from her chronic illnesses, both physical and mental, and we learned from her last hospital visit that she had serious heart condition that needed to be operated on, and she chose not to. So it was like being a caretaker, and it's quite a fatiguing experience. But she once asked me when she was still lucid, how in the world can you write poetry when you're taking care of me? Mm-hmm. We talked a lot about death and about where she's going after death. But the one question I couldn't answer was, why am I writing? It was only much later, long after she had died, that I realized, well, I would probably be in a psychiatric hospital if I wasn't writing, because it became therapeutic. A lot of these poems helped me to get through those years. My wife was ill a very long time, years and years. It only increased in early 2021.
I notice that this collection you're writing with very few stanza breaks, and almost in some respects, it feels like this stream of consciousness. Why did you compose in this format?
Well, when you compose in stanzas, and sometimes if you're writing formal verse, which I don't write in, you're aware of making something artistic. And I don't think any of these poems are artistic. That might be a contradictory. but it's more like spontaneous writing, or what might be called electric writing. In other words, not stopping until you have exhausted yourself, which is what a lot of the poems did for me. They just exhausted my mind. I wanted to compose these so that a person could read them as a conversation.
Yeah.
These are conversations with readers, although I don't know what their thoughts are. But we'll find out if anybody sends a postcard. I think that the writing that I was doing prior to this collection had sort of an objectivity to it. And I hardly ever wrote about any feelings I might have about something. I was always trying to observe without being emotional. I think for decades I would write about something in the world in terms of history or in terms of a text or a painting. That was my sort of place to compose. But these poems have helped me to recognize that I do have emotions. I may not communicate them very well with people, but I've discovered them in me. That's a lot.
What are you writing about now?
Just a second here. This is, I'm writing a new collection called Is, Was, Is, which is confusing to people because there once was a present, and then it's a past, and there's something new, the is. So it's looking back a little bit at life, and as well into the future. I think they're more hopeful poems. At least I would hope so.
We're talking with UW-Whitewater Professor Emeritus DeWitt Clinton. His new poetry collection is called When and If. I understand that you've selected a poem to read for us from When and If. Can you give us a bit of introduction and what you brought for us?
Sure. Here is a poem entitled On Reading Luminous Poems in an Escape. That's a Ford model. While outside, Corona drops people off at the curb or at the nearby hospital or morgue. If it helps, the time is early afternoon, sheltered in a covered parking lot, waiting for someone to draw a blood sample of someone else. The wind outside makes everything move in a way that something natural is about to happen. But most are not masked. The storm is coming soon. Everything will be soaked. We have 2 more weeks or months or more of lockdown. The virus may never leave. One by one, it will find us on every continent. In a few minutes, we will make lunch, find a movie set in deep space where we cannot go or even visit, but we decide to go anyway. Each time when we go out, if we go out again, we will measure 2 weeks before either of us falls down and dies. If we don't fall down, we think we can outlive what's out there. But a dear friend tells us just wait. Try to pretend what could never end. And that's just what we're going to do right after lunch.
I hear urgency and just so much movement in your poetry. It just feels like I'm going and I'm moving and there's a lot of emotion. Do you feel that?
Absolutely. Especially when reading it again after writing it a few years ago. The poems are spontaneous. They're not crafted. Some readers might say, well, this isn't really poetry. I wouldn't argue with that reader at all about that. It's something, and the closest thing to it is poetry. Think about spontaneity. Mm-hmm. Think about letting whatever comes into my old head out. And yes, I'm sure there's some grammatical mistakes, as always. There's some fixing up of lines, maybe adjusting the line length so that it fits on a page. But for the most part, I don't think there's any attempt on my part to make the piece that I'm writing artistic. It's more of a outpouring of many emotions.
That might also feel inspiring and refreshing to someone who's like, well, DeWitt's just letting words fly. I should try letting words fly onto the page.
Yes.
What would you say to that?
I would say, let's do that together or try that out. See how you feel. So much of poetry, when you read it in poetry journals or in books of poetry, you see carefully crafted work. I would be the first to say my work is not carefully crafted. It's more a spontaneous overflow of powerful feelings. That's a quote from William Wordsworth. But he also added, reflected in tranquility. There's nothing in this poetry, in this collection, that's tranquil. Recollected in tranquility means in months or years later, William Wordsworth would write something. But if you hear the quote again, the spontaneous overflow of powerful feelings reflected in tranquility, the last part I cannot relate to. The first part is everything that's in this collection.
DeWitt, before we close, I'm wondering if you tell yourself ever no more, like I'm done writing about COVID, I'm going to do something else or focus on a different topic. Do you do that at all? Do you compartmentalize topics?
No.
Okay.
I can answer it, your question this way, Kate. I taught Holocaust literature and genocide literature at my university for quite a long time. And when I came up to a last sabbatical, I was proposing another study of genocide as it applies to literature. And then in the application of the sabbatical, I said, no, I don't want to do that. I'd like to look at all the world collections of 100 poems. There aren't very many out there. There are maybe fewer than 100 collections, because it's quite a challenge for a poet to put together the 100 best. But I came across a Chinese translation, 100 poems from the Chinese by Kenneth Rexroth. And the first poem was so beautiful. These are poems of the 8th, 9th century up to about the 13th, 14th century. I started writing and I felt like I was under a waterfall, because it was so refreshing to me to be not writing again, not studying again, the horrors of the Holocaust and genocides everywhere. So I'm sure that my meter will change. I'm always sort of surprised what the next day becomes, because I'm trying to live in the present as much as possible, and it's very hard to, because you're always thinking what you've done and what you're going to be doing. So I look upon life as as a surprise.
Well, DeWitt, thank you for your words. What a pleasure. Appreciate this conversation.
Thank you. Nice to be with you.
That is UW-Whitewater Professor Emeritus of English, DeWitt Clinton. We talked about his new poetry book, When and If. He's set to do a reading at Boswell Books in Milwaukee on November 7th. Coming up, a new documentary shares the story of some of the Green Bay Packers' biggest fans in Japan, and how deep is their love?
It's immense. It's as vast as the Pacific Ocean. These people love the Packers, and I think the love is still growing.
The filmmakers behind No Packers, No Life, that's next on WPR News. I'm Kate Archer-Kent.
And I'm Rob Ferret. You're listening to Wisconsin Weekend. It's time for Wisconsin Life. Here's producer Maureen McCollum with a story about finding home within yourself.
How do you travel halfway around the world and still feel connected to home? For WPR's Karina Abrego-Cook of Green Bay, she listened to the sound of her own voice and the voice of someone she loves. She shares her story as part of the Home Is Here project, which amplifies the voices of the growing number of Black, Asian, Native American, and Hispanic residents who call northeastern Wisconsin home.
Two things about me that you need to know for this story. I've always been loud and proud about my family's background and where I come from. Also, I'm an Anglophile, meaning I'm obsessed with British culture. It started with my love of Tears for Fears when I was 3, and then the Beatles in my teen years. Growing up, I was always forthcoming about my heritage. My family moved from Kenosha to Green Bay in 1987, and there weren't many people who looked anything like me in Northeast Wisconsin. So people often flat out asked me, "What are you?" I'm half Mexican, a quarter Japanese, an eighth Irish, and an eighth Norwegian. I'd joke that I'm diverse within myself, or I'd make a new term calling myself Hispasian, or triracial. I remember one time when I was 12, I was talking about our family background, and my dad said, "Yeah, but if you travel outside the country, you aren't gonna say that. You're gonna tell them you're American." That stuck with me my entire life. I had to wait another 12 years to leave the country to see how an exchange with someone from outside the country might go. My friend Sean asked me if I wanted to join him in London for his spring break. It was the trip of a lifetime. While there, we dined with a group of Romanian college students. My family background eventually came up in conversation, and their jaws dropped. They had never met someone with such a diverse background. In a way, it was a new experience for me too, because as Americans, we're used to people having ancestors from more than one country. My trip to London not only got me thinking about my triracial identity, but also my Wisconsin accent. You know the accent with its long vowels. Now, something strange happened in my short time in London. As the week progressed, my friend and I noticed my accent changing. One morning at a coffee shop, I ordered an Americano and I didn't recognize the voice that came out of my mouth. I didn't sound like my Wisconsin self. In fact, I sounded a little British. I was in London for less than a week and I was taking on bits of their accent. I was not totally surprised though. I've always been able to imitate or mimic others easily, though this time it was subconscious mimicking. Was it because I wanted to be British? Not for the food, but you know, the music and the culture, of course. Later that week, we went to the loudest Irish pub on St. Patrick's Day, and I struck up a conversation with a guy from Australia. I'm not sure how he could hear it, but he said I sounded like I was from Canada. And I laughed and I told him that I was from not far from there. So my Wisconsin accent wasn't completely gone. The next day was the moment I was really looking forward to during the whole trip. It was the visit to Abbey Road Studios. After doing all the touristy Beatle things and posing for photos, I couldn't wait to tell my dad about my adventure. After all, he bought me my first Beatles CD, Rubber Soul. Incidentally, it was the first Beatles album he had. I found one of those iconic red British phone booths to call my musician dad, who always fostered my love of music. After he answered, I told him how I walked across Abbey Road barefoot like Paul McCartney and peeped through the studio's iron gates. And it was at that moment, my friend said, that my Northeast Wisconsin accent came back completely. It's because I was talking to Dad in Green Bay. Wherever my dad is, that's home. My name is Karina. I'm half Mexican, a quarter Japanese, an eighth Irish, and an eighth Norwegian. I call Green Bay home, and you can hear it in my Wisconsin accented voice.
Karina Abrego-Cook is an outreach specialist with Wisconsin Public Radio. And her story is part of the Home is Here project from the New News Lab, a local news collaboration in northeastern Wisconsin made up of six media organizations, including WPR and the Green Bay Press-Gazette. More information can be found at wisconsinlife.org. Wisconsin Life is a co-production of Wisconsin Public Radio and PBS Wisconsin in partnership with Wisconsin Humanities. Additional support comes from Lowell and Mary Peterson of Appleton. I'm Maureen McCollum.
This is WPR News.
A new documentary follows a group of Japanese Packers superfans as they make a trek across the world to see the green and gold in action at Lambeau Field. Here's what their enthusiasm sounds like.
Go Pack Go!
Go Pack Go!
I love Packers!
Packers number one!
I love Packers!
Yeah! 18!
The film shows how an NFL team thousands of miles away across more than a dozen time zones won the hearts of people in Japan.
The fan group is called Japanese Packers Cheering Team. They made the trip from Tokyo to Titletown in 2017 after a chance run-in with Wisconsin native Ty Morse.
And Ty Morse joins us now. He is a film producer and subject of the new documentary No Packers, No Life. It's showing on October 15th at Marcus Cinemas in Waukesha, and the film's director, Craig Benzine, is here as well. Welcome to you both.
Thanks for having us. Excited to be here.
Yes, thank you so much.
Ty, let's start with you. Can you put into words how much love there is for the Packers in Japan?
That's hard to do. It took us 7 years to even fit it into a documentary. it's immense. It's as vast as the Pacific Ocean. These people love the Packers. So I think the love is still growing. It's just, you know, there's such a deep passion, and culturally, they hold so much in all the time in their society. So it's just a massive outpouring of passion that, you know, comes in a very unique way. It's very unique because of the culture, how much it comes flowing out at one time.
Why do you think the spirit is so infectious and just so that really translates to people in Japan?
Well, I mean, I think there's a couple reasons. I think one, you know, the Green Bay Packers are a special team. So that creates a special allegiance because they're the team of the people. They're owned by the people. And that's very, very unique. And I think the Japanese have seen this uniqueness and they love that concept. But also, you know, the people of Wisconsin are very passionate and loving. And, you know, they saw on TV, watching TV from Japan, wow, this team's owned by the people. These people just have their own passion that's infectious in Wisconsin. And that translated to, you know, an opening for these people in Japan to, you know, build this desire to become a part of something like that. And through their connection with the team and the people, they started just letting their passion fly.
And Craig, you went to Japan and met members of the Japanese Packers cheering team. What surprised you most about meeting these Packers super fans in person?
Well, I mean, obviously the level of excitement they have about the Packers was surprising. The fact that we met at a viewing party, that they have viewing parties of previous games, and the party felt at once like more intense and more... They were more excited than most parties I would go to here around a game in Wisconsin. But also the fact that it was a pre-recorded game. It was a game that they had already seen.
They knew the outcome.
they knew the outcome, but they reacted as if they didn't. And they were wearing, like, there were Packer shoes. There was one of them had a Packer phone and Packer artwork all over his phone. Cheese charm on one of their glasses.
Yes, yes. Ty, you mentioned this emphasis on culture in the film, and several members of the Japanese cheering team said that Packers fandom is really a way to express affection and spend time together. And I want to take a listen to this husband and wife in the doc who really bonded over the Packers.
We went to the American football game in Japan as a first date.
Oh,
that's
really?
Yeah, wow. it's the first date.
And you didn't know football at the time?
No, not at all. I didn't know the rule. Yeah. But he taught me very kindly. And he explained a lot.
Ty, how do the Packers bind people together and in relationships? What can you tell us about this couple?
Well, the couple's absolutely amazing. And I think, you know, everybody in a relationship has a story of how they come together. And I think that their story focusing around Packer football is beautiful. And I don't think that, you know, obviously this can happen around anything. But there again, there's something unique and special about the Packers being, you know, this super small market team in the middle of America, owned by the people. I think it's you know, charming was something, a word that they would use, our best translation, charming. And that, you know, things like that that are charming, you know, they tend to bleed into our lives in wonderful ways. And so I'm not surprised that, you know, something like this magical moment for these people meeting could happen around a magical team that has a magical story with, you know, a magical fan base.
We're talking about this documentary following Packers superfans as they travel to Green Bay. Craig Benzine is director of the documentary No Packers, No Life. Ty Morse is here, a film producer and a subject of the film. So, Ty, in 2017, you invite 24 Japanese Packer fans to come to visit Green Bay, attend a game at Lambeau. When did it feel real that you are going to be able to pull this off, that it was really happening?
To be honest, it did not feel real until they arrived at Austin Straubel Airport in Green Bay. It was, the entire experience was so surreal. Pulling it together was so surreal. Even the communication, I mean, the Japanese are so detailed. They're so organized. They want to know exactly what's going on. You know, there were so many moments where they're like, why is this all happening? And you know, is, you know, are we going to land and actually be able to attend this game? And will we actually have places to stay? So when they finally arrived and then they saw, wow, everything was, you know, taken care of. That was literally the first moment for me that, wow, this is all happening.
One of my favorite parts of the film is them experiencing life in Green Bay, the farmer's market, and then the Zippin' Pippin' wooden roller coaster. Can you talk about the other things they did during their time here and how you shot that?
Yeah, I mean, we did so much and so, I mean, you see in the film, I mean, we had a house party, Wisconsin style, shot ski and all, right? There was a
more than one,
bonfire.
More than one house party. Let's be honest, more than one.
Yeah, more than one house party. We had bonfire outside. It's fall. I mean, that's what we do in Wisconsin. You get around a bonfire and you drink some beer. You know, one of the judges in Green Bay actually had a Super Bowl ring, and we had a connection to him. And so we brought them to the courthouse and they got to see his Super Bowl ring. But they also got to, they were staying at homes. So they were staying with, you know, my childhood friends, the Grant family and the Demerit family. They were staying in these homes. So not only did we have these experiences that we were bringing them around to, but they were invited into the home, which is not normal in Japan. You don't go to people's homes often. It's a very, very occasional experience. The homes are small, you know, home life is very private. So I think that homestay component of hanging out at these homes, having meals with people, having a beer sitting across the table in somebody's, you know, kitchen or living room, that was a huge part of, you know, the bonding experience as well.
What will you it feel like for you to see it on the big screen, Craig, and see all this work culminate?
Oh my gosh, I'm on the one hand I'm nervous, and on the other hand I'm very excited to finally, you know, show it to just a general audience. It's something I've been sitting on for many years now, kind of slowly piecing together. It's sort of like I've been holding my breath for like 7 years and now I can finally breathe. That's how it feels.
Well, Ty and Craig, thank you for the documentary. Thank you so much for joining us.
Thanks for having us.
Thank you very much.
And that is Ty Morris of Cedarburg, a film producer and subject of the documentary No Packers, No Life. And Craig Benzine of Madison is the film's director. The documentary will premiere 1 week from today on October 15th at Marcus Majestic Cinema in Waukesha. Have you met a Packers superfan in another country? How did you recognize your common bond over the pack? Were you both wearing jerseys? Talk about sports fans across the miles. Email WisconsinToday at WPR.org. That's WisconsinToday at WPR.org. One awesome thing about our job is we're able to meet new people all over the state who are doing really cool things. We get to sample their art, their music, and other ways they make their corner of Wisconsin a little more special.
And now it's your turn. What place in Wisconsin should we pay a visit to and why? What person is doing a neat thing in your community that you want to highlight and recognize? Is there an event we should check out, and what makes it memorable?
I'm always up for a road trip, Rob. Send us a text. You can leave us a voicemail. The number is 888-642-0232. Once again, that's 888-642-0232.
Or email WisconsinToday at WPR.org. That's WisconsinToday at WPR.org.
Wisconsin Weekend is the work of a team of producers, hosts, and technical directors. Learn more about us at wpr.org/wisconsintoday. I'm Kate Archer-Kent.
And I'm Rob Ferret. You're listening to WPR News.